Good evening. I'm Jeff Bennett.
And I'm Amna Nawaz on the NewsHour tonight.
TikTok will remain a place for free expression and will not be manipulated by any government.
In the hot seat, the head of the video app TikTok tries to address lawmakers' concerns that China could access millions of Americans' data.
A new CDC report shows more children are being diagnosed with autism, what that means for kids and their families.
And black farmers struggle to maintain their land in the face of structural racism and economic headwinds.
We see so many of the young people today, their parents or grandparents have had land for so many years, but that almighty dollar speaks, and when it does, they're going to move and the farms are going to be lost.
Good evening and welcome to the NewsHour. The CEO of the fastest growing app on the planet went head to head with members of Congress today.
TikTok has more than 150 million monthly users in the U.S. alone, but faces growing calls for it to be banned over fears about China's access to user data. Laura Barrón-López looks into the potential personal, political, and international fallout should the U.S. government ban the platform.
What started with one viral video is now a full-time career for 27-year-old Alex D'Alessio.
I'll just put it in my little ring mount and hit record. And
2 years ago, he was an engineer working a 9-to-5 and new homeowner of a Baltimore townhouse.
I just used double-sided sticky tape to tile my entire bar, and here's how it turned out. So
he began posting his do-it-yourself renovation projects to the social media app TikTok.
It wasn't that big of a deal. I just had to kind of do it.
Building a home and also an audience.
I mean, come on. The grout just perfectly matches the countertops, and I'm just loving the entire vibe.
One, like, Tuesday morning before work, I was like, let me just upload this video. And then I came home to work, and I was like, whoa. It was like 200,000 views. Like, I had all these comments, and from there, it just kind of started.
Now, with more than 300,000 TikTok followers, D'Alessio runs Real Life Renovations, a brand and a business where he documents his project successes and mistakes, partnering with companies like Home Depot and Benjamin Moore.
Brand started reaching out, and that's when the light bulb really clicked, and I was like, maybe this could be something bigger than it is and eventually be full-time.
So this isn't just a hobby for you, this is your business.
100%.
But he's worried that the new job he's created, which has also allowed him to hire his mother-in-law part-time, could go away.
It just seems like you have no control and the government is deciding for you, which is really scary. I'm trying to like put on a good face, but like that's my business and it's detrimental.
Your platform should be banned.
And it's all at risk in Washington.
Mr. Crew, welcome to the most bipartisan committee in Congress. We may not always agree on how to get there, but we care about our national security.
Are you a Chinese company?
Where Democrats and Republicans share a common enemy in TikTok and its CEO, Shou Chu, appearing before Congress today for the first time.
ByteDance is not owned or controlled by the Chinese government.
Defensive amid a fierce and bipartisan interrogation of the company's safety, privacy, and security practices. Chu was adamant that the Chinese Communist Party cannot access U.S. data through TikTok, as members repeatedly alleged.
Mr. Chu, this is yet another instance of TikTok attempting to mislead Americans about what their technology is capable of and who has access to their information.
Chu pushed back, emphasizing TikTok's Project Texas plan, which puts the American company Oracle in control of U.S. data and content.
American data stored on American soil by an American company overseen by American personnel.
There's no public evidence that China has used the platform to spy on Americans. But lawmakers weren't convinced.
Congresswoman, I have seen no evidence that the Chinese government has access to that data. They have never asked us. We have not provided.
Well, you know what? I find that actually preposterous.
Very American company buy it.
It's been a long brewing fight across two administrations. In recent weeks, the White House repeatedly upped pressure on TikTok's parent company, ByteDance, to sell the app to an American-owned company. And President Biden expressed support for a bipartisan bill that would strengthen his authority to ban the app.
As lawmakers grilled TikTok CEO, dozens of creators who have more than 60 million followers combined descended on Capitol Hill this week to defend the platform.
So I'm asking our politicians, don't take away the community that we have all built.
One by one, they argue the platform is more than an app for silly viral videos, that it's empowered small businesses, promoted creativity, lifted up marginalized voices, and become a mainstay of American life. The average user spends 56 minutes a day on TikTok, more than YouTube, Snapchat, Instagram, or Facebook, according to the data researcher Insider Intelligence.
It almost feels like if you can't beat them, cancel them. I just wish they would try and exhaust all other options prior to potentially canceling it.
Here's just how easy it is to change the outdated light fixture in your home.
For creators across the country, like Alex D'Alessio, recreating what they've built on TikTok on another platform isn't easy and comes with no guarantees that the new business will survive.
What a lot of people don't realize on the creator side is Instagram allows you to post a minute and a half reels. That's the max. TikTok allows you to post 10-minute videos. It's much harder to connect with audience on a shorter video than it is to kind of build your rapport and build your community over a 4-minute video.
So I'll just kind of back that up.
At least half of Alex's income comes from his work on the app. And he and his wife, a second grade teacher, rely on that money.
From one day to the next, if it's gone, you said your income would be cut in half. Yeah. Then how quickly do you think you could even make up that money switching over to another app?
Not quickly. It's not something that I can easily change. I can't just grow an Instagram following bigger or a YouTube following bigger.
D'Alessio doesn't usually follow politics, but said he'd watch the hearing today. Hopeful lawmakers would listen to his generation. In the meantime, he'll continue renovating project by project. But his new career may be built on a foundation that's about to give way. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Laura Barone-Lopez.
For more on the legal and national security concerns regarding TikTok, we're joined by Ryan Callow. He's a professor of law and information science at the University of Washington, and he's closely following all of this. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
TikTok has never been more popular or problematic. And as was evident in today's hearing, the U.S. believes that TikTok might be pressured by the Chinese government into sharing user data. You, as I understand it, believe this prolonged debate, this three-year-long debate in Washington about TikTok, has more to do with politics and less to do with privacy. Tell me more about that.
Well, TikTok, like other tech companies, collects a lot of data about users, maybe more than most users understand. And in that way, it does present a danger to privacy. But there isn't any good evidence that that danger is unique to TikTok as opposed to other companies like YouTube, you know, Google or Meta. What's distinct, of course, is that TikTok has a Chinese parent company. And it seems like a lot of politicians are seizing upon that fact to speculate about TikTok presenting a national security threat.
TikTok's CEO told lawmakers today of this company's plan to store American user data on U.S. soil. In your view, was that assurance satisfactory? Because there's lots of skepticism that TikTok can ever be beyond the reach of the Chinese government so long as it is owned by ByteDance, which is a Chinese company, which is subject to Chinese national law.
Well, it seems like the options on the table are rather severe. One involves forcing a company to sell, and the other is a complete ban on a service that millions of Americans use. And so the third option that TikTok is presenting, which they've nicknamed Project Texas, would keep American data on American soil, and information would only flow to the parent company under very specific conditions and actually have to be vetted by people within the U.S. government. The whole arrangement is enforced technically by an American company called Oracle. So it does seem like a pretty robust measure in place. Now, I understand it's no complete guarantee that China will never be able to access Americans' data, but it does seem to be a compromised position as opposed to a ban or a forced sale.
Yeah. Well, as you mentioned, the Biden administration says it wants TikTok sold or banned. There are political ramifications having to do with that. But legally, how would the U.S. government go about banning a communication platform without running afoul of the First Amendment?
That's a great question. Here, it looks as though Biden might have Congress behind him. Congress could pass a law like the one that they're thinking about, the Restrict Act, which would confer upon, if not the president and the Secretary of Commerce, the ability to vet applications and services for national security concerns and then cause a forced sale or a ban. Now, if that were to happen, I think that courts would react skeptically. First of all, because it's such a serious incursion on the private world for the government to force one company to sell to another or to ban it entirely. And second, because it does raise free speech concerns that you just mentioned.
TikTok is the second most popular app among U.S. teens, second only to YouTube. As we mentioned, it boasts some 150 million users in the U.S. And that speaks to, I think, another source of tension and unease, that at some point in the future, the internet might not be controlled by the U.S. and might not be subject to U.S. values and norms about freedom and security, that China could take the lead.
I have to say that I am more concerned about TikTok's recommendation algorithms than I am about its collection and use of data, especially as compared to other companies. And that's precisely for the reason you just said, right? I mean, the concern I would have is that the algorithms that TikTok uses would surface content that was in favor of the Chinese worldview and dampen criticism. And that's very concerning. So whatever protections are put into place, I would hope that they would have a separate algorithm that is used in the United States that is not beholden to a Chinese agenda.
In your view, do average Americans, just regular TikTok users, do they have reason to be concerned that the Chinese government might leverage their mobile data or their personal information?
I don't think so. And let me say a little bit about why. So first of all, the Chinese intelligence sector has perhaps the most advanced or the second most advanced spying capabilities in the world. And so if the Chinese government wanted to get a hold of an individual's data, they wouldn't have to rely upon TikTok. The way that TikTok could be useful would be to get an aggregate sense of American mood or understanding what Americans' patterns are, or trying to understand us as a people or the young users. But the Chinese government could just as easily, there are data brokers who are happy to share information about Americans with whoever pays them, including China. So I just don't know that TikTok is the most efficient, plausible way for the Chinese government to spy on Americans. That said, as I mentioned at the outset, young users or whomever who is using TikTok should be aware that their privacy is not adequately protected. And what we really need is comprehensive privacy laws in the United States to protect all Americans from all the tech companies that would want to leverage their data.
Ryan Callow is a professor of law and information science at the University of Washington. Thanks so much for your perspectives and insight.
Thanks again for having me.
In the day's other headlines, the U.S. military's top leaders warned it will take sharply higher defense spending to head off a conflict with China. The Pentagon budget request totals more than $840 billion. That includes $9 billion for the Pacific, up 40% from last year. At a House hearing, General Mark Milley said the budget prepares the nation to meet China's challenge and to deter it.
The People's Republic of China's actions are moving it down the path towards confrontation and potential conflict with its neighbors, and possibly the United States. But again, I say, war with China is neither inevitable nor imminent.
Milley also said the U.S. military is recovering from years of war in Iraq and Afghanistan, and that overall readiness is the best in many years. In Israel, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is vowing to pursue what he calls, quote, responsible judicial reforms and to heal deep divisions. But he gave no details in an evening address. Earlier, opponents of a plan to give the government more control over the courts blocked main highways in Tel Aviv again. Police fired water cannons to try to clear the roads. The Israeli defense minister reportedly urged Netanyahu to halt the court plan.
The largest demonstrations yet rocked France today after the government raised the retirement age without a vote in parliament. Tens of thousands filled streets in Paris, mostly peacefully. But police fired tear gas at protesters who attacked stores and lit fires. Across the country, strikers blocked train stations, ports, and refineries. European Union leaders today endorsed sending 1 million artillery rounds to Ukraine within a year. But in a video address, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky urged them to do more and to do it faster.
Let every meeting, every discussion, every day of our joint work bring the return of peace closer. If Europe hesitates, the evil may have time to regroup and prepare for years of war. It is in your power to prevent this. It is in our common power to free Ukraine from Russian aggression this year.
Zelensky also made a new frontline visit, this time to the city of Kherson in the south. He pledged full-scale rebuilding efforts. In southern Africa, the World Health Organization says the death toll from tropical cyclone Freddy has now topped 600. The powerful storm devastated parts of Madagascar, Mozambique, and Malawi over the past 2 months in two separate strikes. The resulting floods ruined homes, roads, and hospitals. The WHO warned today that huge numbers of people face malnutrition and cholera. The World Athletic Council today banned transgender athletes from international track and field competition. It applies to athletes who transition from male to female and have gone through male puberty. International swimming has a similar ban. Also today, Georgia became the fourth state to ban most gender-affirming surgeries and hormone therapies for transgender youth under the age of 18. A prosecutor in New York has rebuffed congressional Republicans seeking information on a hush money probe of former President Trump. In a letter, the Manhattan District Attorney's Office said, quote, Donald Trump created a false expectation that he would be arrested, and his lawyers reportedly urged you to intervene. The letter charged the Republican request violates state sovereignty. Two big companies have announced new job cuts. IT services giant Accenture is slashing 19,000 jobs worldwide over 18 months. That's 2.5% of its workforce. And Walmart, the largest private employer in the U.S., says it expects to lay off hundreds of workers at five major distribution centers. And on Wall Street, stocks swung higher and lower before finishing with modest gains. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was up 75 points to close at 32,105. The NASDAQ rose 117 points, or 1%. The S&P 500 added 11 points. Still to come on the NewsHour, a new report shows a dramatic rise in anti-Semitism in the U.S. Another COVID subvariant causes a rise in cases. Belarus's exiled opposition leader speaks out against the country's latest crackdown on dissent, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
CDC data released today finds an uptick in the prevalence of autism spectrum disorder in the U.S. The most recent data from 2020 reveals one out of every 36 children in America was diagnosed with autism. In 2018, that figure was one in 44. In 2010, it was one in 68. The findings also show how pandemic disruptions kept many younger children from earlier autism diagnoses. For more on this, I'm joined by Dina Gassner. She's adjunct professor at Towson University. She's also a member of the Interagency Autism Coordinating Committee, which advises the government on funding for autism research. She herself was diagnosed with autism at the age of 40. Dina Gassner, welcome and thanks for joining us. A lot of folks will look at that increase and be very concerned. You've said that you see those numbers as good news. Why is that?
Well, my colleague John Robison and I wrote a commentary that specifies that the crisis we're experiencing is not an increase in autism, because this is really reflective of enhanced diagnosis. And as you've seen, you know, specifically identifying Black and brown children, Asian children, as well as being able to identify a few more people assigned female at birth. Unfortunately, the girls are not keeping pace. in terms of being diagnosed in a timely manner as much as their male cohort.
So that rate rose faster, as you mentioned, for children of color than for white kids. The estimates now suggest about 3% of Black, Hispanic, Asian, or Pacific Islander children have an autism diagnosis compared to about 2% of white children. But when you say there's been an increase, does that mean an increase in screening and advocacy? Tell me about that.
Well, historically, a lot of children of color have been assigned inappropriate diagnoses, or their autism expression has been misperceived as behavioral, and they've been really shot into not special ed, but into more rigid behavioral programs, often with really tragic consequences. This is a relief. It represents the idea that some of these children who were lost in these systems may actually be finding their way home.
So this also tells us that many more children will need support services of some kind. Tell me a little bit about the access to services, because we have all heard stories about parents waiting weeks or months just to get an appointment for an assessment. Is that unusual?
No, it's the rule rather than the exception. And to be quite frank about it, it's the rule for people of a certain privilege. You know, if you have the privilege of a solid education, you have the privilege of being able to use English as a first language, you have the privilege of financial capacities to hire people to do things to expedite the process, your child is probably going to be loud enough because of your advocacy in terms of their needs that they get what they need. The people that we try to address in our commentary are the people who don't come with those relative privileges, who may be a Black grandmother in Atlanta raising her second child with autism, right? For people like that, for people who are single parenting and trying to juggle employment and housing as well as parenting and navigating these systems, the outcomes are much more challenging and much more difficult to get through.
What role does insurance play in all of this? How many or how often are these kinds of support services that are needed covered by any kind of insurance?
Well, we do have many things that can be covered, providing you have insurance. But again, that requires someone in the household to be employed. For many people on Medicare or Medicaid, finding providers that will take that income from the assessment process is very, very challenging. Finding people who have expertise in different cultural and ethnic groups, finding people who have that expertise to diagnose for women and girls is really difficult. And then we still have an entire generation of people that were never diagnosed because such diagnoses were not listed in the DSM. There wasn't any category that persons like myself fit into. And so we have to look at this, that although the numbers look better for children, the numbers for adults are still very, very dark and very, very delayed, far beyond a year or 2 years. And it's often wrapped in a lot of diagnostic trauma because people can't find effective and qualified providers.
CDC officials today also pointed out the impact of the pandemic, pointing out that up until March of 2020, there was very good progress in early identification, early detection of autism in younger children. And of course, after March of 2020, they saw a dramatic drop off. And they're worried now about long-lasting effects. Tell us about that. What are those effects they're worried about? Why is early detection so important?
Well, I believe that early detection can be helpful because we're getting ahead of the game. But I would also say that this population is a very resilient population. And I would be worried about kids who are put through the gauntlet faster to try to catch them up. I think if we follow their developmental lead and progress them through growth and personal achievement at their own pace, that will get better outcomes. We've really got to shift our focus away from finding some underlying cure to focusing on why these systems are not getting us better outcomes.
Dina, the fuller picture being painted here is there's more children in particular who will need more help, and there's not enough help there to offer them right now. For families who receive a diagnosis, knowing what you know about the emotional and the financial toll this can take, what's your best guidance to them right now?
Persist. be the noisy person that, you know, just doesn't stop until you get what you need. And I realize when I say that, that's a privileged position to be able to take. I would also say that, you know, we really need to examine administrative burden, you know, that make accessing these services so difficult. And again, I'm going to discuss, you know, adults or, you know, parents who may have co-occurring disabilities of their own. You know, we come to these systems like Social Security or to a social service agency often in our darkest moments. We don't go when everything's successful. We go because we bankrupted everything we had. The systems really are not able to be utilized efficiently, effectively, and in a timely manner.
That is Dina Gassner, adjunct professor at Towson University and also a member of the Interagency Autism Coordinating Committee. Dina, thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me.
A new report by the Anti-Defamation League reveals anti-Semitic incidents increased 36% in 2022, reaching the highest level recorded in history since 1979. The report comes as the FBI and human rights groups warn about the growing number of hate crimes in the U.S. Jonathan Greenblatt is the CEO and National Director of the Anti-Defamation League and joins us now. Thank you for being with us. And Jonathan, the ADL found in this report an increase in three categories. Assaults went up by 26%, incidents of harassment increased 29%, acts of vandalism rose by 52%. What accounts for it and who is responsible for it?
Well, first of all, I would just say I'm glad we're covering this issue, but I wish we didn't have to. But the reality is anti-Semitism is a clear and present danger right here, right now in America. And as you pointed out, not only was 22 the highest year that we've ever seen, we've done this for almost 45 years, this was the third time in the past 4 years that we broke a new record. Literally, the number of incidents has climbed almost 500% over the past decade. So what's behind this? I think number one, anti-Semitism has been normalized and almost weaponized in the political conversation and in sort of public debates. It's now just common course to use anti-Semitic tropes about great replacement theory, about who controls Congress or who controls Wall Street, who's responsible for COVID, and on, in a world in which conspiracy theories are sort of the coin of the realm. Anti-Semitism, the oldest conspiracy theory, has new life. So I think that's number one. I think number two, we have to acknowledge that extremists feel emboldened. When the former president of the United States feels free to use the kind of language we would want our children to use, or to be honest, when we see hardened anti-Zionist activists on college campuses openly, aggressively, and almost gleefully intimidating Jewish students, something is broken in our society. And, you know, truthfully, if you look at the numbers and drill down a bit, the numbers increased dramatically, a 40%+ increase on college campuses, almost a 50% increase in anti-Semitic incidents at K-12 schools. Again, I think it's an indication that there's something really sick with our society.
Let's talk more about that, because I, too, was struck in reading this report about the 41% increase of anti-Semitic activity reported on college and university campuses. And doing more reading about it, what I learned was that Jewish students often say that harassment is often compounded when criticism of Israel arises. Tell me more about that.
Well, look, there's certainly nothing wrong with criticizing policies of the state of Israel. That's common course. That's what it means to live in a democracy. The ADL does that too. But the relentless obsession with the Jewish state, the claims that it's somehow committing genocide against Palestinians or responsible for white supremacy. If you think that a country, the only Jewish state in the world, is somehow white supremacist or somehow committing genocide, of course we shouldn't be surprised then when swastikas show up on the Jewish fraternity, or when people feel it's okay to target and victimize openly Jewish students. So I think we've got to be able to distinguish between legitimate criticism and delegitimizing a country. That constant hackling and hassling and harassment, You know, it's not unlike what we saw happen to Chinese American and Asian American students just a few years ago, when President Trump hammered and hammered and hammered on the Chinese virus or the Asian flu, and then Asian American people were targeted. The same thing happens here. It's wrong no matter who's perpetrating it.
The ADL is recommending that elected officials aggressively denounce anti-Semitism, also that the federal and state governments do more to prevent the spread of anti-Semitism online. In what ways? What does that work look like?
Well, first of all, you're making the right point here, which is we need a whole of society strategy to deal with this. It's not just something we can wait for government to solve or hope that a teacher or principal will do it. Everyone needs to be involved, because anti-Semitism isn't just a Jewish problem, just like racism isn't just the problem of black people or homophobia, the problem of LGBTQ people. Anti-Semitism is everyone's problem. It's a universal concern. So first and foremost, to tackle this, we do need people in public life, elected officials, policymakers, celebrities, to call out hate when it happens. But secondly, something else you referenced, social media. I would tell you that Facebook is a super spreader of stereotypes, and it amplifies anti-Semitism and other forms of hate. So we really think it's long overdue for some kind of government regulation, because, you know, from Facebook to Twitter to TikTok to Instagram, the companies have proven again and again that they're incapable of regulating themselves, which means we need our elected officials to regulate them and force them to abide by a modicum of decency, just like we'd expect from any other media company.
Jonathan Greenblatt is the CEO and National Director of the Anti-Defamation League. Thanks for your time.
Thank you so much.
The number of self-identified black farmers in the United States has dwindled over the last century, in part because of discrimination by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. The agency is the economic backbone for most American farmers through its financing, insurance, and research and education programs. Special correspondent Fred DeSam Lazaro reports from Oklahoma, where despite roadblocks to federal aid, there's a concerted push to help black and other underserved farmers survive.
I knew I was going to do this since I was 7 years old. First time I pretty much got on a tractor with my uncle, and I love agriculture. Wouldn't give it up for nothing in the world.
Did you know how tough it was going to be?
Nope, I do now.
For 50-year-old Leroy Brinkley, self-described hermit, this 80-acre farm with nearly three dozen beef cows is his comfort zone. A labor-intensive, full-time job, but it's one he has to finance by working at least as long off the farm as a heavy equipment mechanic and truck driver.
Why isn't farming by itself a full-time occupation? Because, you know, the work certainly is full-time, right?
Yeah, the work's there, but the money's not. Economically, I don't see this working. It's by itself.
When he began farming three decades ago, Leroy Brinkley tried to get a loan from the USDA. But at the local office, he says he was turned down and turned off by the experience.
I bought the papers in, and it was just no support. I could tell from the get-go I wasn't going to get help. But I tried it anyway, trying to be nice, polite. I still didn't get the support that I needed from it, so I couldn't bother with it anymore.
An experience all too familiar to black and minority farmers.
We've clearly been dumped on worse than any other race in this country by our own federal government.
John Boyd Jr. is president of the National Black Farmers Association and a fourth-generation Virginia farmer. He says African Americans have been systematically excluded from programs that enable farmers to acquire land and build wealth, and unfairly targeted for foreclosure.
The government has to start living up its commitment, and they have to start treating black farmers with dignity and respect.
The government has settled two class action lawsuits in the past 25 years.
Socially disadvantaged producers were discriminated against by the United States Department of Agriculture. We know this.
And in 2021, the Biden administration included billions in debt relief for minority farmers in its American Rescue Plan. But lawsuits from white farmers claiming reverse discrimination held up the program. In response, Congress repealed it last August, instead setting aside money in the administration's Inflation Reduction Act, now for so-called distressed borrowers.
There are a lot of opportunities out there under this administration that a lot of people are not taking advantage of.
Willard Tillman's organization is a resource that connects minority farmers to complex government farm programs. He says there's a rare opportunity to bring these farmers into a system from which they've felt alienated.
If they don't understand it, they ain't gonna mess with it. So that's where we come in.
They don't trust the government.
They trust me. I don't take dirty water to them. If it's good for them, I tell them yeah. If it's not good for them, I tell them no.
Survive with these cows.
With the help of Tillman's group, Leroy Brinkley enrolled in a program last year called CARE, Conservation and Agriculture Reach Everyone.
Those blackbirds, you see how they started?
It paid him $70 an acre for 40 acres, which he used to partner with a local elementary student to bring goats to graze on the invasive species.
I'm going to try to get this covered with a cover crop.
This year, he's participating again, getting support to plant more grass for his herd to graze on.
$1,500 in seed.
Yeah.
Ought to get it.
A little time. Yeah, your time.
Sarah Blaney runs the Oklahoma Association of Conservation Districts, which administers the admittedly modest CARE program.
Our specific program is smaller, but our hope is that this is maybe the first introduction to that process and makes them a little bit more comfortable with the idea of working with government so that when they're ready to go apply for those bigger contracts, they know the right questions to ask, they know what their rights are.
A more immediate challenge for Brinkley is the months-long drought across Oklahoma, which has almost tripled hay prices this year.
So it costs you about $700 per week to feed this group.
Yeah, this is very expensive this year.
Some of his expenses have been offset by a $50,000 loan he received through the Native Creek Nation, where he's an enrolled member, money that was guaranteed by the USDA.
It didn't grow me any. It just kind of took the curves off some things. Maybe the next time, the next go around when this operation is up fully and running, it may make a difference.
The Black Farmers Association's Boyd applauds efforts like those in Oklahoma, but he says the money now available is a fraction of what would have come to minority farmers under the debt relief program that was repealed.
We were promised 120% debt relief, and we didn't get it. It looks like to me every time black farmers are promised something in this country, we don't get it.
The USDA declined an interview request, but in a statement to PBS NewsHour said, given court injunctions that tied its hands, the goal was to get relief to farmers quickly, adding that the Inflation Reduction Act provided $3.1 billion that will allow USDA to work with distressed borrowers, and for those farmers that have suffered discrimination by the USDA farm loan programs, Congress allocated $2.2 billion. But Boyd says the government broke a promise and a contract with minority farmers, and he's suing the USDA.
When they changed the language to distress, it opened it up, and white farmers were able to get their loans and stuff current. There are far more white farmers than there are black farmers in this country. We're less than 1%. We are facing extinction.
Back in the early 1900s, black Americans owned some 16 million acres of farmland, a number that was down by 90% by the turn of the 21st century. Here in Oklahoma, there once were more than 50 all-black towns built around agriculture. Clearview is one of just 13 that survive today.
My family moved here in 1902 when the town was established. My dad had a 40-acre farm. This is where I'll stay until I pass away.
Shirley Nero and her husband Donnie both had careers as educators, Donnie eventually becoming president of Connors State College. But they were both pulled to return to this tiny town 80 miles east of Oklahoma City. Population, about 50.
Most of those people that settled here were freedmen. When Oklahoma became a state in 1907, the first bill they passed was a Jim Crow law. And this was a place of freedom. They could express themselves. They could actually support themselves.
As the years went on, the population and black-owned land eventually began to dwindle.
Our school got down to about 32 in the high school, and then that's when they closed it in 64.
The Neros built their house and now breed cattle here, a rare reverse migration, they admit.
We see so many of the young people today, their parents or grandparents have had land for so many years, but that almighty dollar speaks, and when it does, they're going to move and the farms are going to be lost. And when you lose the land that you have and you now find yourself in a condominium somewhere, the value doesn't equate.
For his part, Leroy Brinkley is open to participating in more farm programs, but based on experience, says he's not counting on anyone but himself.
I've got a little piece of a home, and I'm satisfied. You know, had to move some hurdles out of the way, but I'm making a go of it.
For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Fred DeSanLazaro in Haskell, Oklahoma.
And Fred's reporting is a partnership with the Undertold Stories Project at the University of St. Thomas in Minnesota. And there is more online, including a look at the lives of black farmers through a photographer's lens. You can see those images at pbs.org/newshour.
Three years into the pandemic, cases, hospitalizations, and deaths are all declining. But questions remain about new variants and whether some people may need a spring booster shot. William Brangham is here with an update on the state of COVID in the U.S.
Jeff, it's worth noting good news when it occurs, and on COVID there is some. The U.S. avoided the worst of a winter surge, and weekly recorded deaths from this virus are the lowest they've been since the early weeks of the pandemic. But it is not all good news. More than 1,700 Americans still died last week because of COVID. And for the elderly, the immunocompromised, and those still struggling with the little understood long COVID, this pandemic is hardly in the rearview mirror. For another check-in on COVID, we're joined again by epidemiologist Caitlin Jedalina. She's at the University of Texas, and she writes the very informative Substack called Your Local Epidemiologist. Caitlin, great to have you back on the NewsHour. What is your take on where we are in the trajectory of this pandemic? Deaths are down, as I mentioned, but there is this XBB variant that is subvariant that is now dominant in this country. Where are we?
You know, it's a really good question. You know, I think we're somewhere in between a full-blown emergency like we saw in the beginning of 2020 and somewhere before an endemic. We're just not at a state where we know what this virus is going to do, and this virus is not being very predictable. Like you said, you know, all metrics are nosediving right now, and that's good news. We expect that to happen with spring because of warmer weather, less holiday gatherings. But COVID continues to do its COVID thing and continues to mutate. It's what viruses do to survive. And we're paying specific attention to two XBB offshoots, one in India and one in the UK, that is causing a little disruption in some smaller waves. And so this does have the potential to disrupt a quiet spring in the US, but it's still too early to know for sure given our complex immunity landscape.
Speaking of that immunity landscape, it's been about 6 to 7 months since the bivalent boosters became available, which is plenty of time for a lot of people to have lost some of their protection. You wrote about this today. Is there good evidence for a spring booster?
I think it depends on what you define as good evidence. It's really difficult for us to know how much each booster helps or does not help incrementally and get a grip on it prospectively. And so what we know for sure is that protection is robust for younger and healthier people, keeping them out of the hospital, which is great news. The concern is for immunocompromised and older adults with comorbidities. And this is because their immune systems are just not as strong, and they're being pulled in multiple directions. And so this is a group where we really want to avoid infection in order to prevent hospitalization and death. And we know these antibodies, like you say, that prevent infection wane pretty quickly and only last about 6 months.
And elderly Americans, 65 and older, those are increasingly the people who are still dying of COVID. Isn't that right?
That is correct. I think the last statistics was about 90% of deaths are among those over 65 years old. 96% of hospitalizations are among older adults with at least one comorbidity. And because, again, their immune systems are just taxed. I think the good news is that very few people are in the hospital today who are up to date on vaccines. So the vaccines are working. The essential question is this going to change in time, and what do we do proactively?
I want to touch on long COVID, this still mysterious ailment that so many people are suffering from. What are we learning about who is getting it and why?
You're right. There's millions of Americans right now debilitated, out of work, suffering with very few treatment options. We are starting to get a better grip on what causes COVID. It seems to be several factors, like, for example, a lingering virus, or people harbor the virus in their tissue, which can create damage. Other people get long COVID driven by the immune system. Autoantibodies or just start attacking the body itself. And then there's also just immune dysregulation, that even if someone clears the virus, the immune system is off balance. And so other dormant viruses reactivate and drive chronic symptoms. So long COVID, we're learning, is really an umbrella term for several causes. And this is important to know because it'll allow us to understand how we can target treatments.
And lastly, in the few seconds we have left, on those treatments, there are some that show some promise on long COVID?
There are. There's about 300 clinical trials right now, and the results are starting to trickle in. For example, we see metformin, which is a very cheap drug, reduces long COVID about 40%. Paxlovid reduces it a bit as well, maybe about 25%. So there is good news on the horizon, but we need more answers.
Caitlin Jedalina, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Today, the U.S. and its allies initiated an international investigation into human rights abuses in Belarus. For years, Belarus's government has been imprisoning anyone seen as a threat. It's also become increasingly reliant on Russia and supports Russia's war in Ukraine. Nick Schifrin speaks to the head of Belarus's opposition as the government cracks down on its critics.
This is the rough reality for Belarusian journalists and government critics. Last week, a former photojournalist walked out of his apartment. Government agents who'd been tracking him followed and wrestled him to the ground. His supposed crime, investigative journalism. In another incident earlier this month, police detained a disabled man who had to be hospitalized. Human rights groups say the government now holds more than 1,000 political prisoners. Nobel laureate Aleš Beliatsky got 10 years for, quote, actions grossly violating the public order.
Repressions in our country are intensified. On average, about 17 people are being detained every day. Lawyers, journalists, activists, people are given years and years in prisons for challenging the regime and they opposing the war in Ukraine.
No one symbolizes Belarus's hope for democracy better than Svetlana Tikhanovskaya. She's a former English teacher and full-time mom who ran for president after her husband, Sergei Tikhanovsky, was arrested as he began his campaign for president in 2020. Tikhanovskaya was allowed to run herself, and the opposition says she defeated strongman Alexander Lukashenko. He's led the country for 30 years and claimed he won 80% of the 2020 election that the international community called stolen. After the country erupted in unprecedented protests. But Lukashenko and his Russian allies responded with force, widespread torture, and arrests. Today, leading opposition figures remain detained, and others, including Tikhanovskaya, live in exile. This month, she was sentenced in absentia to 15 years in prison.
We ask to initiate the international proceeding against Lukashenko as a criminal. We ask to recognize his regime as terrorist for his crimes against humanity and crimes of aggression against Ukraine. Those people who committed crimes against Belarusians prosecutors, judges, members of puppet parliament of Lukashenko, propagandists should be set on sanctions for them to understand that there will be no impunity for them. And of course, no lifting sanctions should take place, even to exchange them for political prisoners, because our people don't want to be bargaining chips.
Some 10% plus of the country came out and protested in 2020. If that didn't achieve a new government in Belarus, what can?
Urgent measures have to be taken now to inspire people. When people in Belarus see that they are not abandoned, that they are not overlooked and forgotten, it gives them energy, you know, to continue the fight. So more decisive actions, more decisive declarations will help our people to continue the resistance and win, finally.
And does winning mean a color revolution? Does it mean regime change?
Of course, our main task is new free and fair elections in our country and give people opportunity to vote freely and securely.
Last year, Russian troops used Belarus to invade northern Ukraine. Pro-Ukrainians in Belarus, known as partisans, have resisted the government's support for the war and even used a drone to attack this Russian surveillance plane outside the capital, Minsk.
The beginning of the war, they disrupted railways to slow down delivering of Russian equipment to Russian army to attack Ukraine. And this blow up of plane is also part of peaceful resistance, because our partisans are damaging aircraft that could potentially kill a lot of Ukrainians.
But Lukashenko is increasingly dependent on Russian President Vladimir Putin, despite some awkward exchanges.
Dear Alexander Grigorievich, thank you for agreeing to come.
As if I could not have come.
Well, we are all busy people.
Look, Lukashenko is a full accomplice to Putin, and Lukashenko fulfills all the orders of Putin. There is no task, you know, to split Putin and Lukashenko. The independence of our country is at the stake, and this is Lukashenko who is selling this independence to Putin. So I ask our partners not to make any deals with Lukashenko, not to try like save him. We ask him to save Belarus from Lukashenko.
There are many Belarusians in exile. There are also many Russians in exile. Is there a way for Belarusian and Russians in exile to work together to create a more democratic region?
We can communicate with the Russian opposition. We can share maybe some initiatives, but at the moment we have like different paths. As I said, we have different contexts and maybe different methods of fighting this.
Tikhanovskaya herself vows to keep fighting, but also maintains an earlier promise to step aside if the country ever becomes a democracy.
People in Belarus are united not around one person, not about not around me, but about our aim. And my task to be with the Belarusian people as long as they people need me. Now our people are united as never before, and the regime's trying a lot, you know, to split our unity, but they will fail.
Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And that is the News Hour for tonight. Join us again here tomorrow night for analysis of President Biden's trip to Canada, where he and Prime Minister Justin Trudeau are set to discuss a host of issues facing the two nations. I'm Jeff Bennett.
And I'm Amna Nawaz. On behalf of the entire News Hour team, thank you for joining us.